All right. It is technically time, so we'll get started. You do not need to grab the slides. If you don't want the, they are available in the conference materials. And if this is your first time and you're like, I don't know where that is, in the conference booklet, I think it's on like page 22, we figured out yesterday. Oh, about partway through, kind of like where there's a survey for at the end of the conference is on the right page, on the left-hand page, I think it is. Oh, yes. And there is a QR code there that takes you to all of the conference materials. So I just always, it's one of the first things I do when I come to this conference is I find that, I bookmark it so that I can go back to it throughout. But if you are somebody who wants the individual slides, that is what those are there for you. So we are talking about grading practices this morning and kind of practical. So we're going to talk a little theory, but you are also going to hear some, like, this is what it really looked like for us in a couple different of scenarios. So we're going to start. This is our agenda for the morning. I did not put it over here, but we'll keep coming back to it. We'll do some welcome and introductions. We are going to do a little inclusion tug of war. You are going to have to get up and move around. We are going to talk a little bit about the theory, the three pillars of equitable grading, and then real life in action. What does that kind of mean? What does it mean for us? Then we have time, and this will kind of depend on like how much time we have left. We have set up some time for a panel discussion. I have a couple questions, but like ready to go for the panel, but it will really be opportunities for you to ask all of us some questions about grading practices, and then a closing. So I'll start off and introduce myself. My name is Megan Throm. I'm a research evaluation and assessment consultant at Oakland Schools. I work with all the 28 districts and 23 PSAs in Oakland County around all kinds of things related to classroom assessment. I'm a FAME coach, so I work with formative assessment processes with some folks, but then also like your basic data analysis, off-state assessment. And I was a science teacher, middle school, for 23 years, my science folks in the back. All right.
I think I'm working, right? I'm Jen Howe. I'm Heritage and World Languages Consultant. I get to work with Megan at Oakland Schools. I'll be sharing with you a little bit today about my journey as a teacher, but also as my journey as a consultant supporting this work. I do everything world and heritage languages, and I'm happy to be here with you today.
I'm Nanette Suarez. I'm the Data and Assessment Coordinator in Farmington Schools. And so I will be talking about like what we have done as a district, our slow roll, because you know it's a journey. It's not a 1 year done. We've got it.
Hi, I'm Andrea Halimi. I am a classroom teacher in Farmington, primarily science, but I also teach social studies. So I'm here today just to share with you some of these new practices that I've been implementing in my own classroom and to give some feedback about what it looks like in practice.
Thanks, everybody. And I just realized like one piece of information I didn't put in the slides that I'll maybe throw in. To start, we just would like you to turn and talk to a neighbor real quick. Just introduce yourself. We're not going to go all the way around the room and introduce everybody. Just your name, who you are, like what your role is. And then what is a memory you have of grades as a student? So we'll take a minute. Just turn and say hello to each other and one memory about grades.
You know what we're going to say.
Would one of you be willing to share a memory about grades?
It's okay. You can say no. That's what I'm asking first.
I just told her I don't. I didn't have to use one of those.
Oh. Well, you can. That can be your.
Because we were wondering how many people knew what that was.
I remember it from when I was a kid, but I never had to use it as a teacher.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Would you want to be willing to share something that you remember about freshman or grades as a student?
You can say no. Just a memory you have about getting grades as a student. Yeah.
Okay.
Or being graded. Okay, we're going to come back together. And we could have framed this question a couple different ways. Because we weren't sure who we'd have in the room, but often when doing this work with groups of teachers, we start off by asking about, like, what do you remember about learning how to grade or your first memories, like your first year teaching? So I did change that up here, but part of the purpose of this, too, is to help give you some ideas of facilitating these conversations, like in other professional groups. So one of the things we often start with is, and what we often hear is, like, I just did what my, you know, student teacher did or the teacher that I was working with. I just did whatever they did, right? There was not necessarily anything else. I heard over here that as a teacher, they remember seeing the easy grader as a student, but they never had to use it themselves. How many people used an easy grader at some point? And, you know, it does age us some, right? But it's a little sliding scale that at the top, it's however many points the assessment was out of, and then it tells you based on how many the student got right, what the letter grade is. Is there any other, like, memories that are real strong? Can I get one more? Somebody volunteer. Thanks, Emily. Oh, and thank you, Jen, for...
We were talking about how it seems like always in mathematics, it's like bell curve. Let's grade on a bell curve. And how they take the scare tactic of, like, we were talking about college, and, like, look around you, only half of you will, you know, be here in the end with a positive grade.
Only half of you are going to pass or
will
even
you
less.
Survive?
Yeah. Okay. So not necessarily loving memories, it seems like, from... All right, so we're going to do one other thing. This is where you are going to have to get up and move around. These are real stories. This is a story of a student in 1999, not one of mine. I was not teaching yet. Close, but not teaching yet at that point. So this is from a Algebra 1B, so second semester. And the student had gotten an E during the third quarter. And at parent-teacher conferences, this particular instructor had really, like, if they don't pull their grade up, they're not going to pass, and this is a requirement. They're going to have to come to summer school if they don't pass the course. So the student in the fourth quarter got an 84% B, and then on the cumulative final exam got a 92% A-. What grade do you think the student should get for the semester? These are fancy labels around the room. There's A over here, B in the back corner there, C over there, D over there, or E somewhere up front. So I'm going to ask everybody to get up and move. What grade do you think the student should get?
Just in case they're sharing out.
Oh, yeah.
Microphone.
So they got an E in the third quarter, a B in the fourth quarter, and then on the final they got an E.
Okay.
And I'm going to change the graphic. I don't know.
E, B, and A minus. Okay, so we have a lot of people thinking the student should get an A overall. We have a very large number who think the student should get a B, a couple who think the student should get a C, one person who thinks the student should get a D. I don't think there's anybody who thinks the student should have an E. Do I have anybody who picked A willing to say, why'd you say A? What was your...
Yeah, thanks.
Because they might not have understood things
It's on the spot right now.
I think my answer generally is that I don't know. It depends. I think I love what you just said, and I agree with that. I think I spent a few years in the CTE world at Oakland Schools, and I think one thing that we did that was interesting was we graded on career-ready skills, and like you know, you look 21st century learners like oral communication. Are you communicating? Are you present? Are you doing those things that matter? Which for a long time we were told not to grade on as educators. It's just kind of the final product. So I'm like, well, I wonder. I'm just kind of like, I wonder what that all looked like. Were you slacking off and not really? And then you did this, had this final product that's there. So that's a very long-winded response. Kind of, I guess the answer is it depends for me.
Okay. All right. And then, would you mind sharing why you chose D?
Well, I misinterpreted what we were supposed to do. I thought you thought based in 1999 what they would have gotten. And I did the mathematical calculation of a 20% final and 40% marking periods, but they probably should be an A or B based on they demonstrated the learning at the end, assuming the cumulative reflects that. So
instructor needed to clarify the directions a little bit more for so you do, you're close though in the this. So this is based on, yes, breaking down the way the district had grades set up, right? The course agreement was that, and just to explain these things here, 45% of the grade had to be from the third quarter, 45% of the final grade had to be from the fourth quarter. That's 45 and 45 is 90. And so the other 10, the final had to be worth 10, was only worth 10% of the grade. So the student got an E. The student got an E in this course, or for the semester. They had to go to summer school in order to move on to Algebra 2 the next year. Thank you, everybody, for participating. And the person who shared this story, he was going to record a little video, but I said that wasn't necessary. I could share. Like, really feels guilty now about this reality. But I think all of us probably have some reflection potentially on like, oh, yep, now that I know a little bit better, I would change, you know, how I'm doing some things in the classroom. So that's just to kind of set the frame for what we're going to talk about today. So in Joe Feldman's book, The Equitable Grading, there are three main pillars that he talks about in terms of equitable grading. And this is always kind of a cornerstone of when we do this PL together with groups of teachers. I will say one of the things, too, that I didn't include a slide about, one of the things that's very important to me, We've set this up as a professional learning at Oakland Schools that I actually took over from Dr. Stephen Sneed when I first started 3 years ago. Is to create space and time for people to actually read chapters of the book and not expect anybody to be reading on their own. It's something that's really important to me that is involved. We aren't going to do any reading here today as part of our session just because it's a short session, but so I'm giving you some snapshots. So the three pillars are that grades are accurate, they're mathematically sound, easy to understand, and correctly describe students' achievement, that they're based on valid evidence of students' content knowledge and not other factors that might reflect bias or environment, like outside things. And we'll talk about each of these in a little bit more detail. These are just the highlights, and that they're motivational to students, can help support a growth mindset for students and give them opportunities for redemption. So the first one, accuracy. And I've added a couple things here that are really important to me. But we put this on the scale and going from things that teachers have control over, those classroom focused things, to things they individual teachers probably don't have control over, more systems level things. So the classroom focus are no zeros. Now, there's a lot of controversy about no zeros, and people will complain about the no zeros and that we're making things too easy for kids. So that I always make sure it is important that this is no zeros in a 100-point percentage scale. And we'll, I have an image in a minute that kind of, I think, shows what mathematically why that's problematic, and the book goes into those details more. But the zeros in a percentage 100-point scale have some really detrimental effects that you can't recover from. Kind of like, even though those weren't zeros with that student example, but even then, because that 100-point scale is unequally weighted, a low early performance can sometimes just be, you can't recover from it. So how can we motivate students to want to continue to do well if maybe mathematically, if they have figured out, it doesn't matter what I do, I can't overcome this. So if I'm in a percentage scale, not having zeros. Minimum grading, so this is a way that some places deal with the, instead of no zero, they'll set a full, like the lowest grade you can possibly give a student. And again, this is like in that percentage scale. It's to make up for the unequal weighting of the different areas of grades that students could get. The middle one I really struggled with, grading individuals, not groups. I did a lot of group projects in science that were kind of summative. Mentally, also, I thought of them as the way to, like, make the test less stressful. Like, you're going to have a test and a project, and the project you'll probably do better on. And that's going to help your grade out overall. It really isn't a true reflection of students' understanding, though. And so it does also think, like, what is it I really want my grade to be communicating? Is it about, the other people in my group really knew what they were doing? Great. Or is it about what I know? Weighting more recent performance, that example we just gave in the person who shared about why they pick A, right? The final exam was the most recent performance. I do think this one lends itself to some content areas more than others, right? Some content areas you maybe are assessing the same thing multiple times over time, and so you could replace an earlier grade with a more recent one. I think probably many of us have been in courses where it's, we'll drop the lowest score. But if the most recent grade is the lowest score, and that really represents where you're at, so that's something to kind of consider. And then a more system-focused thing would be changing the scale. And an example is a 0 to 4 scale. People automatically think, like, we're not ready to go standards-based. You can change the scale without going standards-based. Just saying, you know, those things aren't, you know, they don't have to be intertwined. And it is not saying just give everybody A's. So in my personal experience, and I know this is not everybody's experience, my grades went down overall when I started getting more honest about what their grade represented. I had fewer A's. My bigger issue was fighting with folks and getting complaints from parents that their kids weren't all getting A's anymore, and they were instead getting like B pluses or A minuses. But it often is it was a more accurate reflection of what students really knew. So this is just the image, and again, there's probably work to be done on making that prettier, but this has hit home well with educators about why in the 100-point scale, the zero is, and it's how unequally weighted it is. So I just compared it with the GPA scale, which some folks will talk about, like that's a 12-point scale. Or 13, if you whether really you might think of this 100-point scale as a 101-point scale because the zero is a thing, whatever. These are debates that people get into. But that zero doesn't have as big of an impact in a GPA scale as it does in a percentage scale. So that visual I have just found to be really helpful when talking to people about when we say no zeros, we're talking about in that example on the left, because there's so much more room for failure in that scale, it's unequally weighted. So this is my example. This is from my example. When I taught eighth grade science early in my career, I had a student, and at that point, it was each quarter was like equally weighted. So they got a C first quarter, they got a D plus second quarter, and then an E, and then an E. And taking those, their final score in my course was an E. And the counselor came to me and said, Megan, if you use the GPA scale, they should pass. And my reaction was, you are just trying to, you know, like, just be too nice to them.
But really, in the GPA scale, they did end up with a D. It was a passing grade. And just as a reminder, that can be confusing to people sometimes. They see the 0.825 and think 82.5. Because we are so ingrained to turn everything into a percent. But GPA is, we end up turning kids' grades back into GPAs anyways, right, at the high school level. And they got a D using that GPA scale. So that's just another example of those. The other grading practices relating to bias resistance, so again, going from classroom to system focus, basing grades on required content, not on extra credit. I feel like a lot of folks know the Kleenex box shouldn't be a part of what grade, but you'll see it. I've seen it recently. So it still happens that students get points for things completely unrelated to what they're doing academically. No grade penalties on you. Again, that's not saying don't penalize late work or not have some system to deal with it. And you can't let kids turn in a bazillion things at the end. But if you think about these things on a continuum, and if we don't grade homework, that one in the middle, well, then the other one about late work actually becomes less of an issue. Because if I'm not thinking I have to put a grade on every single thing, the whole, they're just going to turn everything in at the end of the semester becomes less of an issue. If my grades are graded primarily on summative assessments, and not on all the things we're doing formatively, then there isn't a bazillion things that they're turning in the end to get the points. It's not about the point grubbing necessarily at that point if I'm just looking at that final product. I'm not saying there isn't reasons to track completing that work along the way, and there are other ways to do it, but those formative things along the way, again, those grade penalty on late work becomes less of an issue, or at least for me, when I stopped grading every little thing the kids did, when I stopped entering every little thing they did, that became a non-issue now. They didn't really have to worry about it. Excluding effort and participation grades, having non-grade consequences for cheating, again, that's not saying don't have consequences, and then grades based on the summative assessment. And one of my favorite things I've heard students say to groups of people about this late work, the penalty for not doing the work is doing the work. Like, I'm going to be so annoying to you and bug you, the penalty for not doing the work is doing the work. And then moving on to the last one, thinking about motivation, this is often people like, yeah, but if I don't grade things, kids won't do it. Listen, I think high school probably has a little bit more difficult of it. Like, we have trained them by when they've gotten to that point. So, me as an individual 11th grade teacher, a little bit bigger of a fight than if we could, as a group, collectively start working on this a little bit earlier and start to get students a little bit more used to not everything being graded. So, there's some reality there. And again, you could find other workarounds. Enter it in, but make it not count. I gotta tell you, I don't think my students ever really noticed when I did that. I could have columns in my grade book that got recorded in Schoology or whatever that were weighted as zero. Right? So they still saw the record, the parents still saw the record, but it wasn't counting. So if we think about emphasizing self-regulation, thinking about retakes and redos. I mean, not unlimited retakes and redos. I didn't have, a point, and we only have so much capacity. Using rubrics, working towards more feedback and a community of feedback with self-care assessment. Renaming our grades, and again, grades based on standards, not points. That's more systems. That is getting into standard-based grading, right? And that's more of a systems thing, and the individual teacher probably can't. So now we're going to hear from some other folks about their experiences with these concepts.
So I'm first, and I think watching Megan, it feels like this is the right place to stand, to not block the screen. So thank you for helping me to figure that out. So as an educator, my journey with more equitable grading started in 2015, 2016, that school year, when I was a high school educator, but a world language educator, and our middle schools in the district at the time were going to full standards-based grading. So in the middle school, no one got an A, B, C, or D on the report card. They got a 0 through 4. The high school had not participated in any learning at this time, but as world language teachers, we were really curious about what does that look like? Because we are not trying to help students grow to getting an A in speaking German, in my case, or French or Spanish or Arabic or ASL. We're trying to get students to know where they're growing and how they're doing and being able to understand and communicate in that language. So we went to our principal and said, middle school students get high school credit for world language. And our department works really hard together with our three middle schools to try to make sure that our program is aligned. So we would like to experiment with what this might look like in our high school classes. And he said, great, next school year, we're gonna start studying Ken O'Connor's 15 Fixes for Broken Grading, and I will buy your teachers the books if you wanna try it out this year. That's how the middle school started transitioning. So we were really, when I present places and people say, how did you do this? How did you get your department to do this? I would echo what Megan said. There are some things that you can do as a classroom teacher, and there are some things that are much more systems focused, and you need both of those things. And we were really fortunate to have leadership that said, yes, go ahead, take some risks and try some things. So as you can see up there, the middle school had transitioned and we got some support. I found the same thing as Megan found, that in the beginning, I was seeing less A's because now my grading scale is more mathematically accurate and it depends on what the students can do and where they fall on a rubric as opposed to that they got a 92 over a 93 that makes the difference between the A minus and the A. But also because the kids were now focused on the rubric and what might it take to get a 4, they were looking at that rubric and they were saying, oh, if I want to get a 4, I need to add this to my communication. And so they were really thinking about what they could grow there. I also found that fewer students were in that D or E category for the same reason, that the students that are in class and are doing the work and are practicing and are engaged in the instruction, they don't know zero German. They know some German. And in that mathematically inaccurate scale, and math is not my language, so I had to work really hard to learn this and be able to explain why the 0 to 100 point scale is not fair to my colleagues. In that, they were looking like they know no German. And they were thinking they know no German. But when I shifted to a 0 to 4 scale along with my department, they were saying, I'm a 2. I can do some German. I can also get to a 3, and then maybe after getting to the 3, I can get to the 4. So that was how my teaching career went, continuing to learn and change. And also, I think Megan usually does a really great job of saying, when you learn these things and you start making these changes, you probably will feel very guilty for the students who were in your classroom before you learned those changes. But you need to give yourself grace as a learner. So I appreciate her saying that, and I would echo that too. I would say every year looked a little bit different, and I would tell you that I left the district to come to Oakland Schools in 2021, and this is still a progress. So while we might be up here in an hour and 15 minutes telling you, like, this is what it looks like, and we hope that you can do it too, growth takes time, and systematic growth also takes time, so don't be discouraged by that. I think we're ready for the next slide. Oh, okay. I was like, whoa, I'm ready to change. Oh, okay. This will jog my memory a little bit to tell you that it wasn't all smooth sailing. Some highlights, like I said, were students were more confident in their language abilities, so they knew what they had to do to get to the next level. And I really found grading their work easier, too, because if it was a summative assessment, I was filling out a rubric for them, but I was also putting a glow and a grow. And so they knew something that they did really well, and they also knew, like, what is my next step? As opposed to, I also taught ninth grade ELA and had some ELA learning experiences myself where you would turn in a piece of writing and it would come back with whatever the teacher's favorite color was, lots of marks on it. Not always red, maybe it was purple, my favorite color is purple. And then when you're looking at all of those marks, you don't know what to do. But when you're looking at a rubric, and you're looking at structure, for example, or you're looking at something that says, here's one next step, it really builds confidence, which is what this is about. Okay, so the rubric supported growth, and then even with parents, instead of talking about this is an 84, you could talk about this is what your student can do in the language. But then the challenges are, this is a big one, when teachers start thinking about retakes, how do you manage those retakes? How do you make sure you have a new version of every assessment that you think it's necessary to give? When do kids do it? There's a lot of questions about that. And it takes a while to find a system that works for you and that works for a department and that works for kids. The zeros is a big hurdle sometimes, or what do we do about absent work? So you have to have conversations about that. It's helpful if you have systematic support. And for us, the gradebook was a challenge. At the middle school level, kids and parents only saw 4, 3, 2s, and 1s, and there was a spot in the middle school handbook that said, if you're curious what this might look like for your high school GPA, here's how you figure it out. But they never talked about A's, B's, C's, and D's because they didn't see those in PowerSchool. They just saw where they were at and possibly where they could go. But we were required to still give a letter grade at the high school level because we were the experimenters and because colleges require GPA. That's an argument probably you'll get as you are making this change. And so we had to do some interdepartmental work about, like, how do we transfer our rubrics to a letter grade or a percentage in the grade book? And we used some of those mathematically accurate processes, like let's have a minimum floor for us so that we're putting things in out of a percentage, but we're not putting them out of a 0 to 100 percentage. We're putting them out of a 51 to 100 percentage. Okay, so then as a consultant, I attended Megan's sessions, and some school districts like Farmington sent teams and invited me to sit with their teams, and they invited world language teachers on their teams. So that was a good experience for me to say, what's new in the world of standards-based and equitable grading, and how can I support districts as a consultant? And this year, I am offering some after-school Zoom sessions for grading in the world language classroom. So you can do some things, I think, whole staff, and then your teachers, no matter what content area they are going to say, what does that look like for me? What does it look like in visual and applied arts? What does it look like in PE? What does it look like in Spanish class? So I'm trying to support that as well.
So I'm that blend of Jen. I was a middle school math and Spanish teacher. So prior to pandemic, I was still in the classroom. And we also did the 15 fixes. And I will tell you, explaining the math behind some of these practices to my Spanish teachers in my department was easier than my math teachers. My colleagues, they fought me more, right? So prior to the pandemic, my math department in my middle school did the same thing. We had done the 15 fixes. And then as a district, we had started to adopt some of the fixes. Since then, we had a lot of staff changeover, and we had issues with the rollout. It was basically a mandate. You're going to do these 4 fixes. There's a lot of confusion as to the why. There was a lot of, the district told me not to take points off because for late work. Like, literally would say that when I walked into the room as this role, right? So pandemic happened, and during the pandemic, we did great. Everyone is willing to accept late work and the way they assess, and then we all went back into the buildings. And I'm like, I don't want to look at a grade book because it was just back to the old practices that they had done prior to 15 fixes. So we started to reengage with grading work in the previous school year. So, and you know, getting subs is a problem. And so I was able to take a small group. So there were 5 district leaders in different positions, like MTSS, myself, a curriculum coordinator, and I had 5 teachers, Andrew being one of them. And we were able to attend Megan's workshop. And what happened after the first session, it's like, we need to start bringing this stuff back to the district. We didn't wait for all 3 days. So we started to share it. We call them instructional leaders. Some districts call it department heads. But they have monthly meetings with my boss. And so we started to share some of the learning with all of them during last year's school year. And so we decided as a district, even from those teachers in that room, we need to focus on this for the next school year. So this school year, every middle school, high school teacher in our district did an asynchronous module. We have some asynchronous hours we're required to do. Just an introduction to the 3 pillars, right? So the ILs, the department heads already knew what they were, but this was now everyone, right? Now, the high school admin decided they also wanted to focus on it truly in their building. So they facilitated PD during our first week back, the teachers are back, with some support and slide decks from yours truly. And we are continuing to have the conversations with our high school instructional leaders this year. This year, high school and middle school have split their meetings, so it's a little bit different with middle school that Andrea can share about. I was able to, though, there was such a need for, we need more teachers to be talking about this, that I was able to take a larger team to Megan's workshop this year. So I went again. But this time, I got building admin to go, which helps the conversation, because if only teachers are talking about it, then they don't have support in the building. And that's what we kept hearing from the ILs, is like, I'm doing these things, because some of them were trying them out, but then they didn't have support in their PLC when a colleague would argue with them about some of the practices or not want to get on board with them. And so now we get into our highlights and challenges, right? So we have more people engaging in the work. That's the highlight, especially our admin. High school admin have been calling me after launching Learning Week. They're like, oh, we just did it that first week, and then they've done nothing. And now second semester hit, and they're looking at their grades from first semester, and they're like, "What is why are there all these Fs in Algebra 1 and Geometry, right? Well, I'm assuming that's not just my district. But so then they're having conversation. I'm like, well, let's take a look at the assessments. Let's look at the weighting, all of that. So they're now re-engaging, and they want to they're understanding that we can't just make tights. They really want me or my boss to tell them, this is what you're going to hold over your staff members' heads and say, you have to do this. If I don't see this in your grade book, and we're like, it can't be that. We have to have the conversation. There has to be a why. We need to be able to communicate, not just with our staff, but with the students and the family, so everyone's on board. We need the common language. Having the three pillars, honestly, for us has made it so that we can keep talking about motivation, bias, resistance, accuracy, has made it consistent between our two high schools. And we continue to have requests for more PD on this topic. I have some Spanish world language teachers who have been going to Jen sessions. We had some teachers who were voluntold to go with me to Oakland schools, but then they're coming back sharing their information. My favorite quote, and I had to look in my notebook, is one of our teachers, when you talk about the minimum grading and people fight you on it, one of my colleagues in the room said, congrats, you get a free F. Like, what does it, why are you fighting me on giving a zero, not, you know, versus giving a zero versus a 50 when we're using a 100-point scale? An F is an F. What does it matter, right? So, like, that whole conversation, but I just love that quote, and I keep saying it. Congrats, get a free F. Okay, so some of the challenges. So the conversations at the building department level. In some departments, they're still having the conversation. World language would be one of my examples, where they talk together to see how are we grading, what are we doing. They're looking at their assessments. They're looking at what they're doing in the classroom. But then I have other departments where they did it at the PD in August and have not had another conversation. So we're still struggling with getting that conversation. The pushback misunderstandings, the whole no zeros, oh, that's a tight. That people get so upset with it. And then I talk about, well, maybe it's a not yet. I'm like, because if I don't put a zero in the grade book, they're not going to understand the impact. Well, why aren't you talking to the kids about the fact that they didn't turn something in? Why are you just depending on my star or sis to tell them? Maybe you could talk to your students about what they're missing, right? Misunderstandings. We had our ILs, our department heads, work through, take a grade book, take out all of the compliance homework, and see what the grade would be for that student. And it was in that moment, and now we only have two econ teachers in the district, so everyone knew who they were talking about, but a special ed teacher said, look, my student right now has a D in this class. If I take out all the compliance homework that they haven't turned in and just look at their assessment scores, my student would have a B. And the room got real quiet. And that's the thing, is like, I depend on my special ed and my EL teachers who are in every single classroom. They see the practice, malpractice, whatever you want to call it, in every room. They see it, right? They understand what's going on. And this whole challenge of tell us what to do versus don't tell us what to do. I get it from the admin and I get it from the teachers. Nanette, I'm tired of talking about grading. Just tell us what to do. Okay, one, I'm a teacher leader. I'm not an admin. But if I tell you what to do, then you can, because I've heard it, you're going to go down the hall and say to your students, well, Ms. Suarez or the data assessment coordinator told me I can't take points off, but you turned this assignment in 3 days late, right? Like, I don't need my name cursed throughout the district, nor should it be, right? Like, we should be talking about, hey, you can still do this. You are still a student. If you fail your driving test, does that mean at age 49, I'm never driving again? No. I can do a retake? Why is it I have so many hoops to jump through for a retake in this class? So just trying to have those conversations is interesting, especially now we're focusing on the high school, middle school. Some of the admin have been in the conversation and want to start having the conversations. The teachers, middle school teachers who attended last year as well as this year, really are pushing the admin, hey, we need to start talking about this as a building. And that's without me telling them to do it. They're talking to their admin. So it's become a little bit more organic. But like you can see, we are on a journey. It's going to take us a while to get there. So we're going to have Andrea. Oh, you just had the one.
Yeah. All right. So over the past year, I've been implementing some of these changes into the classroom setting. So you can see, you know, the standard grading, the way we did things in the past and what it looks like now. And I think that the big takeaway for me this year and having changed to 100% summative is that there's a shift in the focus for kids. So as educators, I think we all take ourselves too seriously. We look at the grades and we calculate and we make sure that, you know, are we hitting every single standard? And we're not really portraying to kids what the learning process is about. So if we're focusing on, are you showing growth? Are we learning? What is the point of these grades anyways? They start to take a little bit more ownership of their learning. So rather than hand back a paper with a big zero on it, they're starting to see, like, okay, maybe I didn't get all of this right, but what do I need to learn from here? And rather than look at those, you know, purple marks all over the paper, they look at what am I growing in? Where do I want to be? And so the feedback becomes more real and more relevant for them. One of the things about grades that make them so personal is not only that it's personal to each student, but I feel like as colleagues, we all take our grading policies and our practices extremely personally. They're used to compare what did your students get as opposed to what did my students get, and it's really not showing anything at all other than numbers on papers. So what are we using this data for? How is it driving change within our classrooms? But also allowing us to have grades be personal for specific or all students. For me, that looks most, you can see it most prominently in each of the individual kids and getting to know them on a personal level. And if you're stuck in the no zeros, you know, you might have a kid who came in and you know they're going through something personally at home and they don't have their assignment done. And rather than you get a zero because you didn't do it, it's how do we encourage you to now take that learning and to make it something that's important to you. So at the end, you know, you've actually shown growth rather than, again, looking at a number and in a grade book.
Okay, so for what I wondered at one point if that wasn't for me.
Do you want this one?
Sure.
And I don't know if you guys want to use that.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Nope. It's just me. Just me and my natural loudness.
I work in the lunchroom, so they tell me I have the loudest voice. That's what I'm going to win. So Stephanie and I, I'm Dan and Stephanie, we're instructional coaches in Wayne Westland Community Schools for the high school, and we're kind of going through this right now. All the high schools are implementing the 0-4 scale, and we're running into pushback, if you can imagine that. It would possibly happen. One of the things is the grade book. So you guys said you use PowerSchool. Does it naturally set up for a 0-4 scale, or do you have to manipulate it like we do in MyStar, and they see that a 20-some percent is a D, and they flip their lid, and then some people are actually grading. If they get a 20-some percent, they get a D, and I'm just like blowing my mind that that's happening. So that's my first question. I have a couple more.
So when I was in Lake Orion, they used PowerSchool, and the middle school was using PowerSchool Pro. It was new then, and they just completely someone had to program it, and maybe PowerSchool helped with that. They just completely took any percentages out. Parents and students never saw it on that end. And then at the high school level, we were not using PowerSchool Pro at the time, and so we still had to put percentages in. So we did the programming on our back end that if a student got all fours on a rubric, then if it was out of 100, it was 100. If it was out of 10, it was 10. If they got twos, it was something else. So they were seeing the percentages, but they weren't seeing like what you're asking, like a D, a 20% or something like that. They were seeing the 50% or higher. My children were students in a different district last year, so I just saw the parent view of it, and they were using PowerSchool also, and you could see the standards in there from the parent view, and you could see the numbers. So there must be a way that a programmer can get those percentages out for you if you don't want them, because as a parent, we had to say, okay, what's the logic rule? How do I figure out what that grade might be? Did that kind of answer your question?
It kind of does. We can do that for the parents and the students. It's the teachers still see it, and then they are flipping out because they think a 20-some percent is a D because they don't understand the math. And I agree. I'm a math teacher by trade as well. And the math department is the hardest pushback on all of this because the other departments don't understand it anyway, so they just whatever.
So I guess I would say to PowerSchool or your PowerSchool programmer, what do we need to do to turn this off for teachers too?
It's MyStar. So we've done that, and there is no answer we get. We go through Wayne Risa, and they don't know how to shut it off either. So,
yeah, because what we were told years ago when we thought about possibly going to standards-based, but it, from the MyStar team at Oakland Schools, was that it's a all or nothing, meaning everyone at the high school level would have to do it. We can't, like, have people choose, because we had some departments who want, like, world language, of course, was ready to, like, go, but, like, so our teachers are doing, like, the bad math behind it to try to make it work in the MyStar system.
Yeah, it's all the high schools have to do it, so they're all set up the same. So it's just the problem is if the teachers just didn't see it and they just said, I'm giving an A, B, C, D, E, 0-4 scale, I think it would be a lot better. But thank you for that. My last couple questions. First, what is your plan to continue teachers to be learning about the three pillars at the high schools coming up? Because I do think that's important in the role, but our teachers don't really understand the why. So you could elaborate on that.
So going back to the three pillars, we actually picked like one from each pillar, like one practice from each pillar that the admin, because they realized they needed to continue the work, are focusing on technically at their staff meetings for the rest of this year. They had desired at some point, like, emails or something, and, like, no one's reading emails, so we're not sending out another newsletter. Like, that's not. And then what we've also talked about is whether or not we send more teachers next year, because the ILs, the instructional leaders, are a little tired because they did it for the first year. They're like, let's just go. Like, they just want it. We also need to have time, we're talking about either in the March date or in Launching Learning of next week, where departments have the conversation versus the admin having the full staff having the conversation, because it is going to look different. The way this is going to look in a Spanish classroom versus in the math classroom is going to be different. And so they need to have those discussions now in the spring so that in the fall we can say these four elements we're practicing. So we're taking the list of all the elements in each of those three pillars and deciding what are the ones we're focusing on, ideally that would start in the fall, so we need to talk about them now for 26, 27. We game out like how many, it's going to take years, but yeah.
And I'll just add, just from working with other districts, right, who are doing this in different ways. So one of our districts did have essentially like spent a full year doing the book study. So at staff meetings, that was the time they read like a chapter each staff meeting throughout the year. Then at the end of the year was like, okay, now after all this, what are the things kind of similar, but like, what is it again? And they did the same exact thing. That staff also comes to me, goes, tell us what to do. And I'm like, no, because if we just tell you what to do, hey, most people then figure out a hack around and don't do it, right? Like a year or two after anyways, it does need to come, has to come from inside the house, right? Like it, the desire has to be there. So they spent that year reading the book, and then at the end of the year kind of collectively decided on where as a system they should start. Again, that's still not going perfectly, but it at least just even the conversations about like having some common organization of rubrics, just as simple as are we going 4-3-2-1 across the top or 1-2-3-4 seems silly, but just having some coherence about some of the ways we're communicating with kids. If I go to three different classes and you all orient your rubrics differently, how do I know, right? No, I'm not looking at your rubric because it looks so much different than what I get in another class. So they've kind of started focusing on some of those things that, are kind of, I feel like, easy wins that are concrete, gives folks something to do that is related to the conversation.
Yeah, we're one of our colleagues, another instructional coach, is coordinating with all the content teams, the core content teams, and they're creating common assessments and common rubrics this year, which they will not be done with it by the end of the year either. But the last thing, and then I'll give up the mic. I'm sorry. I've read both of the Feldman books cover to cover, both versions, so this resonates with me. So I'm sorry, everybody else. But I just got moved to Career Tech as an instructional coach this year to support the math there. And their thing is they grade based on the workplace, like competencies. So they grade on if they're absent, things like that. Does that jive? Because I'm like, I don't know what to say with that. It like goes against everything I've read, but it is part of their standards that they have to do.
Well, that's right. To me, that's part of their responsibility. And I don't know that that's the answer, but I've had this one's going in and out too. I can't win. Some of the performance courses, right? Like a choir or something with it. Well, participation has to count in my course because that's. It's a course, right? So I do think it comes back to if we are articulating what the learning goals of the course are and the grades are tied to, you know, those learning goals, that's a different, but I don't know. Like I think at first I was like, yeah, no, participation should never count. And then I'm like, oh, well, yeah, there are instances.
Yeah, they do have actual, that's part of their expectations as students learn workplace expectations, I guess. So I just thought I want to be okay that I just roll with it and go.
And I just wanted to jump into as you know, seeing this from inside of the classroom, it is a very difficult task as a teacher not to look at the kid who's late every day, doesn't turn in their homework, doesn't participate, and gets an A on the end of the unit test.
Yeah.
Because you so badly want to teach them all of those skills that come along with being a productive human. And so really just establishing what are your grades reflecting and keeping that bias out of them. And I think that in talking with colleagues, that's probably the biggest hurdle that we face, because the most common thing that I have heard is, well, how are we going to make sure that they do the work? Well, we can't. And I don't think there's any perfect grading policy anywhere that's going to ensure that kids are doing it. But, you know, like I said, you determine what it is that you're grading on and do your best to keep out all of the other gray.
Yeah. But, and I'll say, I have had the same conversation, whether it's CTE, whether it's world language, because we also sort of like changed and looked at our definition of participation, because it's like, if they're not being safe, or in phys ed, if they're supposed to be running and they just sit there, then they don't have a score. My example, because I was language teacher, I'm like, right, if they stand up there and instead of telling me in Spanish what they're wearing, they tell me in English, I have nothing to assess you on. So, like, that's not, you know what I mean? Like, so participation, what we counted as, so we had to, like, reframe the definition of participation. Because if you're not doing it, like, I have nothing to grade you or assess you on.
We had a question over here, I think.
Hi. So, being in the classroom, and I'm totally on board with a lot of things you're talking about, but the practicality of retesting, like, if you're teaching bell to bell, when is there time for retesting, and how many times is someone allowed to retest?
So one of the things that I have implemented this year, I teach primarily science, and our curriculum has the gotta have checklist for the entire unit. So that has been something that I think is helpful. Each of the students will get that checklist at the beginning of the unit. They look through it. They know what the expectations are. They know the standards they need to hit. And they are given the responsibility of holding on to that checklist. And as we move throughout the units, there's the little check boxes. And if I see that they've mastered something, whether it's through conversation or a hands-on activity or the end of the unit test, I can just kind of check it off. If they see that it's something they have not hit yet, then they're able to look at it and show it to me. And so it's more of a teamwork approach to making sure that all of the retakes don't fall on the teacher. And I think a lot of times we get caught up on a retake has to be a piece of paper where we look at it, we grade it, we put it in a book, when in reality, if the kid explains something that they maybe didn't get before, just because it's not written down doesn't mean that they haven't mastered that. So that checklist, I think, is really helpful. And also just, like I said, taking the pressure off of yourself from having formal assessments ready for retakes. Just finding ways throughout the days to check their understanding.
I was doing kind of similarly, but I did have a formal process for retakes, but not feeling that burden to have the whole test, right? Yes. Like in a whole nother test. I built it into my classroom schedule where everyone was participating in a test reflection. And essentially it was a Google form that you responded to. You were looking at the assessment and not every question, but the learning targets, right? It was organized that way. And then how did you do on that learning target? And then depending on that response, it either took them to a single open-ended question about that learning target or kind of went to something else. And that way everybody was doing it, right? It was because I did used to do the come in at lunch or come before school. That's not equitable, right? That's not really fair. And that's too much for me. So yes, I did give up a day, but then, and even if students did well and everything, again, it had something further for them to do. Again, I don't think that's a perfect thing. And, you know, and some of the articles and whatnot is something that I introduced this year to this group talking about equitable grading, or some of the arguments against some of the articles. And one of the most popular articles against the Feldman equitable grading work, like, did a survey of teachers, But they really asked the questions in shady ways. And one of the shady ways they asked the question was about having to do unlimited retakes. Right. Nowhere in that book does he argue for unlimited retakes. That's not possible, right? There are constraints, but having letting students know, I think that relates to that motivation, that there is some opportunity. And again, like Andrea said, that opportunity doesn't have to be a full test either. That can look a couple of different ways. I think it really depends on the context and the course too.
And it doesn't have to be on every assessment. Right. Yeah. Or every standard.
Yeah. Yeah. I know some folks who will put questions or items from previous assessments on like the next assessment. And like that's when your opportunity is. You're sitting down to take a test anyways. If there were questions that you wanted to readdress, this is your opportunity to do it. So other questions for the panel? I really appreciate you guys asking questions. This is one of those I have no, you know, when you have no idea how it's going to go.
Okay. Just a practicality on the no zero. So in the motivational component of it, so on formative assessments, we're giving feedback, and that's why you're not doing the zero is because I'm trying to make sure I'm clearly communicating what I'm trying to think. So you have a student, they didn't turn in their work, you can't give feedback if they don't turn it in. How do you communicate to them, practicality-wise, that they haven't given you that assignment in order for you to give them the feedback they need without giving them a zero
on some way? So I have finagled my grade book in a way where I still enter assignments that are not weighted towards the grade. And so that will sometimes have a zero because I use it as a placeholder to show you didn't do this. And part of the way I think it works motivationally for them is when they come to me and they say, you know, I really want to do a retake. I want to, you know, get my grade up. What can I do? That's when I have them go back and look and see, like, all right, where are your zeros? This means that you didn't do the practice in order to earn the retake. And so it becomes a little bit of like a game with them of if you're not completing the assignments and doing the work, then I'm not allowing you to continue to just take stabs in the dark at, you know, can I do better this time? So like I said, it's that placeholder for you got a zero because you didn't do it. It's not affecting your grade, but it's a way for us to reflect back and look at, okay, what was this assignment? And if you had done that assignment, what would the learning have been that impacted the grade at the end? So it's, there are so many moving parts and so many pieces that are not perfect. But I think that little steps like those zeros help kids visualize their learning a little bit better and to take a little bit of ownership in it. So they get to the end of a unit and they see like, oh, wow, yeah, I didn't do three assignments. Maybe that's why my grade is what it is, rather than either not putting those zeros in. But like I said, they aren't weighted. And so they see it and it's a representation for them that it's a zero without it actually impacting their grade.
Yeah, there was another district that their math department went to not grading homework because they found out at prom last year. Yeah. They got shown the chat that was everybody sharing the homework, right? And they realized, why are we grading all this stuff when we just know everybody's copying and cheating? But then they have had that kind of flip problem where they went to not entering anything. And it is parents have so much access to, right, everything now digitally, right? All the digital stuff is a blessing and a curse. And parents wanting some record, then them also realizing, like, oh, we have to record something before the unit test, right? There maybe should be some record of what things are happening. So they are working on, again, thinking about maybe like that example that I gave, that was kind of like, we would think of it like a quiz, right? Like a mid-unit starting off kind of formative, I'm getting feedback, but then there is some record of how well did you do on the thing, because it kind of shifts, right, from being formative to summative once you've done something with that feedback, ideally, right?
And,
that's the goal.
And even on those non-weighted things, I used to do this in the classroom, and I talked to our high school math department about it as well. They can still put in comments. So they could say, like, it's not turned in. Like, and they can say, like, because I was using, my students were assessing themselves on a scale and, like, knowing that if you're aiming for level three, like, if you're not seeing on these formative checks in that you are a Jedi Knight, that you are, sorry, I'm Star Wars. But my parents knew Jedi Knight, Jedi Master were three and four. Anyways, they knew, like, so if you're going into this assessment and everything you've turned in is either not turned in or it's like a two or a one, your youngling Padawan, you are not ready for this assessment. And so this explains why the performance on this assessment. And I never had an argument from a student nor a parent when they looked at that to say, oh yeah, they really were not ready for this assessment. And we probably should have studied more or come in for practice or done something in order to prepare.
We are about out of time. So I want to thank everybody for your great participation. There's some resources in the slides. We've referenced a lot of the books people have talked about. I'm kind of currently reading that Engaging Parents and Families in Grading Reforms. I'm meeting with the district next week where their board is reading Feldman's book first. That's actually where they started. So that's an interesting kind of point of view to think about. And thinking about engaging families is an important part of this that I think sometimes people really miss. The Dweck books are phenomenal and really helpful. I started with Grading from the Inside Out. That's where, as a classroom teacher, that was my first introduction to thinking about these things, just personally. So thank you. Thank you so much. Can you give my panel participants, because I roped them into coming with me today. So I am greatly indebted to them, and thank you guys. For